Hi, I'm Melissa Corkum. I blog at our family website, www.thecorkums.com, which we affectionately call The Corkboard. This is the Uncorked Podcast, conversations with everyday extraordinary people, people who have conquered, people making a difference in their worlds, brave and beautiful people, but people who in the end are just like you and me. If there's one thing I've learned over the past 10 years, it's about how much I didn't know that I didn't know, and how much I still don't know. Our experiences in adoption and loving kids who have aged out of the foster care system, living in the country but owning a coffee shop in the city, and just traveling internationally have so greatly expanded our horizons and shifted our paradigms. And hopefully, we're better humans for it. The one common theme through all of those experiences, though, was just listening to people's stories. Patty Dye once said, "The shortest distance between two people is a story." So pull up a chair and an open mind and meet another one of my everyday extraordinary friends. Welcome to episode 20 of the Uncorked Podcast. If you listen regularly, I'm so thankful for you and hope you're having as much fun consuming as I'm having producing. Would you do me a favor? Would you head to iTunes and rate the show and leave a quick review? In the podcast world, that's the best way to share a show that you love so that others can discover it. This week, I have Jen Ernest joining me. As you'll hear, Jen and I have been friends forever. You'll want to make sure you check out the show notes page at thecorkums.com to see our rockin' 80s style. Jen has walked through pregnancy loss, secondary infertility, adoption, breast cancer, and she's parenting a child with limb differences. That's a lot of situations where people tend to say all the wrong things. I'll confess, I'm not the smoothest in these situations, so it's with great grace that Jen gives us some awesome insight and advice on what we could do or say that would be way more helpful and appropriate. We also chat about the importance of bacon in her adoption story. Hello, bacon. Here's my conversation with Jen.
Hey, Jen, welcome to the Uncorked Podcast.
Hey, Melissa.
So we met in elementary school, grew up on the same street together, and if I can find the epic picture of the two of us on our first day of first grade off of Facebook, that's what we're going to use for the show notes page. So, yeah, I'm really excited that you're here today. And so here's the lesson for being on the podcast. Jen listened to one of the previous episodes where I interviewed Erin Gang about her adoption and her pregnancy loss and all of those things. And Jen made a mistake of commenting on that post and said, "Hey, great podcast. I would love it if you would do a podcast on what not to say." And so what happened is she had a great idea, and now she's been commissioned to be on the show. But she is the perfect person to be here because she has walked through all kinds of situations that have a whole list of what not to say. So, Jen, why don't you start off by just introducing yourself, tell us kind of who you are, what makes you you.
Okay. Thank you. So I am Jen, and I am 35, and in my short 35 years, I've been through lots of different trials and tribulations, you could say, and a lot of those have given me lots of wisdom into what not to say to people when they go through hard times. My husband, Josh, and I have been married for almost 13 years. We have a 12-year-old son named Luke and a 10-year-old daughter named Faith that are biological. We have one baby in heaven, Hannah, who would have been 5 this year. And we have 2 amazing adopted sons from China. Noah was our first, and he is 5 now, and Nate was our second adoption, and he is 6. So we have had pregnancy loss, we have adopted children, and last January I was diagnosed with breast cancer, so we have been battling that this year on top of, you know, our normal crazy lives of raising 4 children and homeschooling and all that fun. So that's me.
Yeah, and you totally had room in your life to have cancer. Yeah. Not that anyone ever does, but I mean, adoptions and all the things.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like the say things happen in 3. So you should be pretty much good for life. I mean, you're done.
I think so, but you know, who knows?
Although that puts adoption as kind of a bad thing, which it isn't. So I don't want to say that. But like hard things, big adjustments, all.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. So you're the expert. expert on what not to say. So I'm super excited about this because as much as I'm an extrovert and I love people, I am really awkward in hard situations. So I would say that even as an adult adoptee and someone with adopted kids, I've probably said all the things that you're not supposed to say to an adopted family. And sometimes I feel like I get a pass because we are that. And so I don't know. I feel like, well, I get it. So like, I'm not saying it to be rude or ignorant. I just, you know, I get to say it because I'm living it. But I mean, the truth is I'm just awkward with words sometimes in weird situations. So
right.
Excited.
And I think a lot of us are. Like, I think when hard situations come up, you know, a lot of people don't know what to say. And, you know, I myself have done it and just totally put my foot in my mouth trying to say the right thing, and it just doesn't come out that way. And I think a lot of people just kind of need to hear, here's a good thing to say, or here's something, just don't do it. You know, because we don't know. Like, especially if you haven't been in the situation, you don't really know.
Yeah, I appreciate that. So let's start with your pregnancy loss. Will you just share what it looked like when you walked through it, kind of how you processed it?
Yeah. So when we got married, about a month after we got married, I got pregnant with Luke, which was not in our plans, but clearly in God's. So, you know, getting pregnant obviously wasn't hard for us. When he was about 18 months old, I decided that he wasn't a baby anymore and I wanted another baby. Looking back, I was insane. And we decided to, you know, get pregnant again. And, you know, months into trying, you know, we're pregnant with Faith. So it was super easy. And then Faith was my hard child. Still kind of is my challenge most days. So I decided I was done. Two were good. We had a boy and a girl. Perfect. Done. Which is everybody will tell you, oh, you have one of each. You're done, right? You know, because they like to judge. And then my best friend got pregnant. And, you know, when you're growing up, you always want to be pregnant with your best friend. You talk about it, you know, since you're little. So Luke and Faith were a little bit older at the time and we've been done. And then, you know, my best friend's pregnant. And so I get the baby bug and was like, oh, okay, Josh, one more, please. You know, when we originally got married, I wanted 6 kids. I wanted to have 4 and adopt 2. He wanted 2. So I was like, okay, 3 is an association. You're only adding 1 and I'm like subtracting 3. So, you know, that's fair, right? So he's like, all right. And, you know, I kind of talked him into it. So I'm thinking, okay, you know, I'll be pregnant next month. Well, not really. It actually, we tried getting pregnant for probably a year and a half with no luck, which was really a hard struggle because, you know, I got pregnant so easy before. So it was really weird to, you know, to go through that. And then for a lot of women who suffer from like secondary infertility issues, you feel kind of like you can't say anything to anyone because I already have 2 kids, so I shouldn't. You know, if I can't get pregnant again, I shouldn't be upset by it because I already have kids, you know. And it was hard, kind of a struggle to be able to talk to other people about it, you know, because I had friends who weren't able to get pregnant at all and, or, you know, had lots of difficulties. And so I didn't want to say anything to them to make them feel bad. But at the same time, I was kind of suffering in silence with it. During that time, we actually also found out that I had Lyme disease, which, you know, at that time we thought, oh, okay, we'll get antibiotics for a month and we'll be treated and all will be good. But the Lyme disease actually stayed around for about 7 years and actually only kind of just went away with my chemo, which was, you know, one of the benefits of chemo, I guess. So then, about a year and a half after trying, I had some really bad stomach pain one night and, ended up calling Josh and telling me to come take me to the ER, which I never want to go to the doctor. So he knew it was bad if I told him he had to take me to the ER. So really horrible night in the hospital. They did a pregnancy test right away and they told me I was pregnant. I was in the emergency room alone at the time because Josh was getting someone to come get our kids for us. And so I started like bawling when the doctor told me I was pregnant. And then I'm thinking, you remember that show, I Didn't Know I Was Expecting or something? I totally thought, oh my gosh, I'm like 8 months pregnant. I'm in labor. Like, this could be what's happening here. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't want to gain weight. This is the best pregnancy ever.
Right. I can just imagine thinking, I've just been so busy with these 2 toddlers.
Right. So the pain increased and it got really bad. And I was like, okay, this obviously is not a good situation, whatever's happening. So they ended up doing a sonogram. They did an external sonogram and they looked around and they couldn't see anything. They're like, oh, well, you know, if you're only 4 weeks along or so, then, you know, we might not see anything right now. We'll do an internal just to check. And it's like, okay. So they did the internal and we all saw like clear on the screen was a little baby. You could see little arms and leg buds moving around. You saw a perfect little heartbeat. But it was clear that the baby was not in my uterus. So the woman who was doing the sonogram just looked at me and said, "I'm really sorry." And that's all she had to say. So we went back to the emergency room, and they called an OBGYN at that point to come in for emergency surgery. They had determined that so the baby was actually implanted outside of the uterus and outside of the fallopian tube. So it was just kind of in a cavity next to where my uterus is. They have no idea how it ended up there. It's like a 1 in a million chance that if a baby conceived falls out of the uterus, that it can attach to anything and grow. So I was actually like 8 weeks along, and the doctor just came in, and I was like laying down flat because my blood pressure was so low that if I sat up, I passed out. So he kind of like squatted down and turned his head so he was like eye to eye with me and just looked at me and said, "I'm sorry, I can't save your baby." But it was like the most perfect thing a doctor could have come in and said, you know, that he recognized that it was a baby and that I was upset by the situation. And so they did do emergency surgery. Because of where the baby was implanted, I was actually bleeding internally. So, you know, if I'd waited any longer and not gone to the emergency room that night, it would have ended very differently. So it was a very traumatic kind of hard loss to go through. You know, luckily I survived it. But for me as a mom, knowing that I lived and my baby didn't was really hard to accept, and even harder for some other people to understand in a weird way. So that was our pregnancy loss journey.
Wow. I just didn't know that was possible to have an embryo escape outside the uterus and the fallopian tubes.
Yeah.
But I guess it makes sense. I've had some friends lose IUDs, so is it maybe that's the same kind of thing?
Yeah. There was, and when they did the surgery, they couldn't tell, like, there was no tears in the fallopian tubes or anything. Like, the doctor was kind of dumbfounded as to what had happened or how it had happened. So, you know, I always say I have really good odds. I should play the lottery. And Josh was like, "Yeah, your odds are, like, good in a bad way, though. So maybe not."
Maybe not. How public was that? Like, did a lot of people know that was going on? How did that play out?
It was devastating to me what happened. And I just felt like I couldn't keep it quiet. Like, I didn't want to not tell people what happened. Like, I wanted people to know because I felt like it would have been weird to hide it, you know, to not talk about it. I know a lot of women do because it's such a private thing, and it's also something that a lot of women feel like shame about when they lose a baby. But I felt like I had to talk about it because I felt like so many other women don't. And when I told people what had happened, I had all these people like private message me, "Oh, I had a miscarriage. Oh, I lost a baby." And I had no idea that any of them had ever happened to them. And I just felt like there needed to be a voice saying, you know, this thing happened to me and here's how I feel about it, to try to get other women to talk about it a little bit more. Cause I feel like a lot of us just keep it so private that we never get to like share it, and we kind of, you know, bury it within ourselves, that if we talked about it, it's something that, you know, you could get more help on, or, you know, be able to relate to somebody else and not just kind of suffer in silence.
Yeah, I am an oversharer, for better or for worse, for sure. And I'm an active processor, which I think, I don't know, I'm sure they go hand in hand. But I found that the blessing in that is the people that come out of the woodwork who thought that they were so alone. And then because of my big loud voice, you know, we're able to say, "Oh gosh, you know, I thought I was the only one, and I'm so glad I'm not." So God bless my family for putting up with me. There's really no concern of privacy in our life, but I think because of those situations, I'm just encouraged to continue to overshare. So, like I said, for better or for worse, who I am. But I think those are the situations that make me think, like, I don't need my privacy as much as someone else needs solidarity.
Right. Like, I feel like we need no one should suffer in silence with anything. I feel like that's what, you know, pushes so much depression and so much, you know, like self-harmful thoughts to people, is like they're suffering alone when they don't have to be. You know, there's someone else who understands you. And I feel like a lot of the grieving process happens when you know you're not alone. Like, someone else knows what it feels like. That kind of just helps everything. And, you know, I'm a huge believer in like the stuff that we go through in life. Like, we should share it, you know, as hard as it can be. One, it helps us to get through it. And two, like, things happen, you know, and God gives us those stories to share with other people for a reason. You know, if we keep it to ourselves, like, what was the point of going through it if we can't use it to help somebody else? You know, then it just makes it like this horrible, sad situation instead of making it into something beautiful or something that can be used for good.
Going through that situation, what were some of the things that people said to you that they probably weren't thinking about before they came out of their mouth?
A lot of the things that were said were, well, you already have two, so, you know, you're good, you know, so it's okay that I lost a baby because I have two babies. A lot of people said, well, at least it was early in the pregnancy. You know, I was 8 weeks along. I didn't even know I was that far along because of where the baby was. Like, I still had a normal period, so I didn't even know it until the doctor told me at the hospital that night. And I don't think, you know, not, I haven't lost a baby later, but I don't think it makes it any easier at what stage you lose the pregnancy. When it's a wanted child, any stage is going to hurt to suffer that loss. You know, I don't think we can weigh or measure loss like that, you know, so for people to say, oh, at least it was early, you know, it's kind of like, kind of a dagger to me. I know they were trying to be nice about it or say something, you know, clearly those were people who have never lost a pregnancy at all to say that. They were just trying to say something, you know.
Or I feel like sometimes people say things like that because they're feeling so uncomfortable with your pain, and it's uncomfortable for them, so they need to minimize it for themselves. But that in turn makes you feel like, it just makes you feel like they're not hearing you or understanding you.
It's ridiculous that I'm upset about it. Like, don't diminish my feelings, like, just because you don't understand it, you know, which is kind of the problem with our entire society, I think. But, you know, and then there's, you know, as a Christian, I believe that life begins at conception, and I believe that my baby was my baby, and that, you know, I have lots of friends that aren't, and that's fine. They're still my friends, you know, but to say things to me like, oh, well, you know, I mean, it was so early that, it, you know, it was still just, you know, like, not even a baby yet, you know. Like, no, it was a baby. I saw her heartbeat perfectly. I saw little arm and leg buds move around, you know. So to diminish my beliefs on top of that was just kind of like, okay, you know, that might be what you believe, but I don't need to hear that.
Right. Well, or also, like, I mean, if we just take that to full completion, like, those things are, like, because they're smaller or because you didn't know about it as long or because they're younger. So, like, if we just take that full on and we're just like, well, like, if a kid dies in a car accident instead of a parent, well, like, at least they were little. Or,
right,
you know,
right.
Or if, like, if you lose a friend you've only known for, like, 3 weeks instead of 20 years, like, well, at least you didn't know her that long. Like,
right, like, you fix
it just
better,
doesn't transfer the same way.
Right, not at all. And then, you know, there's, I'm a firm believer, I'm pro-life, you know, I believe everybody deserves a chance to live and in life and stuff, but I know a lot of Christians are very firm in their stance of, like, you know, anti-abortion, and it's this horrible thing, and, you know, basically what I had to go through was an abortion because it ended my baby's life, even though, you know, a couple hours later I would have died and then the baby would have died anyway. But there were very devout, strong, a little bit crazy Christians that would, you know, that has said things to me about having an abortion.
No.
You know.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like, well, you know, the baby would have died anyway, and I didn't have a choice.
All right. So I feel like that, like, takes the cake. We could just drop the mic right there. Mm-hmm. Were there any other things that people said that were just not helpful during that season of your life?
During the time, is a lot of people just kind of pretending it didn't happen because they didn't know what to say to me. And I understood that. I understood, like, I mean, I barely understood what I was going through. And it was hard to express it to other people. But, you know, I needed to mourn. I needed to grieve through that time. And, you know, people would reach out and wanted to see how I was, but didn't really want to ask. And which I understood, you know, it's a hard thing to go through. Minimizing what it was the worst part of that.
Yeah. Makes what were the helpful things that people either did or said or didn't say, or what would you recommend, having lived through that situation, what do you wish people had done or said?
So I think, like, the best thing people could have done, and probably a few people did do, was just kind of come around me and surround me in that time and just say, I'm so sorry. I can't believe this happened, you know, and we're just there to support me. Like, what can I do for you? You know, if you ever want to talk, I'm here. You know, just kind of giving supportive comments in that way and acknowledging my loss, too, like, not pretending it didn't happen. For us, we, you know, the baby was only 8 weeks along, so, you know, we couldn't see the gender or anything yet, but Josh and I both, as soon as we saw that sonogram, the thought that popped in both of our heads immediately when we saw the baby was, it's a girl. So we both just felt that way. So I would tell people, you know, when I refer to the baby that we lost, I'll, you know, say our daughter or whatever. She'll be like, well, it was too early. You couldn't tell, right? And I say, well, no, but I just knew, you know. So to just be like acknowledging her was helpful to me. Like, I'm so sorry. You know, I would tell people, you know, I'm so sorry you lost your daughter, you know, or something that gave her life. Josh and I also chose to name her, which is actually something that my mom had suggested, which was really helpful. She had lost a pregnancy when she was younger, and someone had told her to name the baby so that you give them, so you're remembering them as a person and you're acknowledging who they were, even though the world might not. So we named her Hannah Marie. So we acknowledged her. We both got a tattoo, you know, all of our kids that we had at the time with their names on it and hers included, just to, you know, remember her. So for people to acknowledge that is always great for me.
All right. So moving on, you guys decided to expand your family through adoption, which I'm sure, and this could probably be its own separate podcast, was a phenomenal conversation between you and Josh, since you clearly wanted two children. You had a boy and a girl, which everyone apparently knows is perfect and means you should stop all things.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you ended up adopting. And so there's just not language. There's not enough language. And people are certainly moving our culture towards better understanding of this language. But we definitely have a long way to go. And so what does it look like? Well, first of all, I guess, just like kind of how your boys came to be with you.
You know, my whole life, adoption has been around me and it's been something I've always wanted to do. I think actually your baby sister, Lindy, was probably a huge reason for that.
Because
she was just the cutest fat cheek baby ever. So like my whole life, I've kind of had this dream of adopting an Asian baby. And, you know, I let Josh know and he wasn't really on board at first. Kind of the typical dad side of adoption that happens a lot is, you know, oh, they're not mine. I don't know if I could love someone else's child, you know, because it took some convincing to, you know, have kids and have more than two kids. And so anyway, we, when my best friend had her son, I was her nephew, my husband totally was, you know, head over heels for him and realized, oh, wait, I can love other kids that are not biologically mine, which, you know, we all know, but he needed to learn that for himself. So once that kind of happened, it kind of opened the door for him for adoption. So God had put a lot of people in our lives who had adopted, and it just kind of pushed that envelope a little further. And then letting go of being able to get pregnant again was a huge part of it for me. And once I did, once I finally kind of released that to God and said, you know what, whatever your will is, I'm open to it now. I totally was ready for adoption after that. We had friends who had adopted internationally from China that we'd become close to, and getting to see that relationship with that father and that daughter really kind of spoke to my husband. We were actually at their house for New Year's one year, and the next day we had breakfast together, and she had like a piece of bacon in each hand and was like chowing down on it. And he just kind of had this epiphany that if they had never adopted her, she never would have had bacon, which, you know, bacon's a huge thing in our family.
Really?
So that kind of broke open this, oh man, there's this need in the world more than just, you know, at home for these kids, you know, and so we...
Yeah, forget Jesus, forget clean drinking water, education,
right.
Really, bacon. If we could spread bacon to more orphans, the world
that's exactly it. So we actually started a Facebook page for our adoption story, and I named it The Bacon Revelation, because he had this revelation watching this child eat bacon that opened up his heart to international adoption, which I just think is the greatest story
ever. I mean, God, it clearly proves that God can use anything, and he knows us all so well. I mean, who would have thought?
Yes. He knows perfectly that the only way to get to my husband was through bacon. So, so that's what kind of opened him up, and as soon as that started, you know, I found this an agency that I just fell in love with, and, you know, she matched us with Noah. She emailed me one day as I'm sending all of my documents to her to be sent to China. She's like, I got everything uploaded. We're sending it now. Do you want to see a picture of your son? And, you know, bottom of the email was the most adorable little baby ever, which was Noah. And I was like, I replied to her right away. I was like, yes, yes, yes. And she's like, no, no, no. You have to talk to your husband. You have to, like, review the file. And I'm like, okay, but Just so you know, the answer is already yes. There's a process.
It doesn't matter. Okay. He's already in.
Yeah. And so I sent it to my husband, and just when I looked at his birthday that they had marked, which is, you know, their best guess, was August 19th, which is about exactly a month older than our daughter would have been if she had been born. So that, as soon as I saw that, I was like, this is him. This is, you know, God's taken his story of loss and our loss and is weaving them together in this beautiful way. So this is our son, you know. Not that this is what was meant to be, but this is what God has made out of something bad that had happened to both of us. That was our Noah, which I was like, okay, this is it. I'm done. I got him into three kids. This is the baby I've been waiting for. Like, he's, you know, sort of be like the perfect addition to our family, and he really was. But while we were in China, so the couple that we were traveling with, they were adopting a 4-year-old little boy, and he was just awesome. And getting to see him and meet him was just a great experience, seeing a little bit older of a child. Noah was just under 2, but really was more like a 1-year-old. So it was really like having kind of a baby again. So seeing an older kid, I was a little bit nervous about if we had adopted a little bit older. I didn't think I would be able to handle that, but meeting him kind of softened my heart to that a little bit. And actually, the day we got Noah and brought him back to our hotel, my husband looked at me and said, "Oh, we're doing this again." And I was looking around the room for like where my husband went, because this was not him. And he was like, "You know, we're coming back and we're getting someone a little bit older." And I was like, "You're crazy." When we got home, he completely changed his mind. He was like, "No, we're done. I was just kidding." And then at that point, I was like, "Oh, nope, sorry. I already called the agency. We're starting again." So about 6 months after Noah came home, we started the process. There was actually a file of a little boy that I saw that I kind of just, my heart really broke for. We started to pursue him, but another family kind of beat us to it, which was a perfect family for that little boy. But in that process, it kind of opened us up to saying, you know, okay, my husband's like, all right, yeah, I'm ready. So we actually told my agency to send only him the files and let him go through the files of boys. We wanted another little boy. The boys that they had available between ages like 3 to 5, I think they're fully put. And I said, you look at it, and when you see one that you feel fits our family, then you show it to me, because I will fall in love with it when they show me. So I figured it was probably best to do it that way. So we had gone through, you know, several, and we were kind of, we actually went on a family vacation. We were in Disney World. And my husband had told them, you know, like, I need a break. Don't send me anything right now. Or, you know, we're on vacation. And while we were there, our agent sent him an email. Like, I know you told me not to do it, but I found your son. Like, he's perfect for your family. And he was. And so my husband looks at the pictures and reads the file and then just looks at me and I was like, what? And he was like, she sent us a file. And I was like, should I look at the file? And he was like, yeah. I was like, okay. So that was the start of a process for getting to Nate.
And he has limb differences. And so there's, again, probably a whole list of things maybe that either kids have said or even adults have said regarding his limb differences and his special needs, because they're visible special needs that probably are up there on your list of just what not to say.
Yeah, that could probably be like a whole thing. So for Nate, yeah, he has the lower part of his leg is shorter than it should be. We're also in the process of getting him diagnosed with a form of dwarfism. So he's a little bit shorter for a 6-year-old. He's about the size of a 4-year-old. So yeah, a lot of people look at him funny or will ask questions about why is he walking like that? Which, you know, don't do that, especially in front of the child. And because we also have a 5-year-old, they're about the same height at the moment. So almost everywhere we go, everyone says, are they twins? And I say no. And I understand you didn't really look at their faces because they really don't look anything alike besides the fact they're both Chinese. But they look completely different children. When people ask me, are they twins? And I say no. Typically they say, really? Like with a question. Like I forgot.
Like you lied.
Right. Like I'm lying or like I forgot about it.
Like, the innocent question about twins almost feels like an icebreaker or, like, you know, I don't really know what to say. But yeah. The really?
Yeah, and, like, the really is because I would look at them and be like, oh, yeah, nope, totally forgot they are. Whoops, you know, like.
Do you ever do that? Because I feel like that's the kind of answer that I'm in the mood to give these days.
I mean, I have been known to give one of those kinds of answers. Actually, we had to do like a personality test when we were adopting Noah. It was like these little quizzes we had to do as part of our home study. And it kind of gave you what personality adoptive parent you are. It's kind of weird. But I was like a educational/comedic. So like try to make like a situation lighter by making a joke. So I've done that numerous times. A lady at Walmart looked at Noah and looked at me and then it's asked, does he look like his dad? And I said, maybe, and walked away.
My mom used to get that a lot. She would ask like, oh, is your husband Chinese or like, you know, whatever.
Right.
I want to take that personality quiz. Is that like online?
It was online. I'll have to find it.
So adoption, what else have people asked you about the boys in the story adoption wise?
So we always get the typical, are they real brothers? And I'm like, yeah. I would typically answer yes, but they're not biologically related, to kind of educate people. And then they kind of, if they're, you know, thinkers, they'll kind of give that look like, oh, well, maybe I should have said that. Or if they don't, then it just kind of goes over their head and then I just move on. So yeah, like asking if someone is a real brother is not okay.
Or a real anything. A real anything.
A real anything, yeah. As opposed to a faith. Yeah, like just think about
that. But here's the problem with that even. So, and I think about this a lot, but I haven't really voiced it. I really don't even know where to go with it. I'm beginning to even have a problem with biological, mostly because of the same thing. Like, what does that even mean? And like, does that mean that the other people aren't biological? Does that even mean anything?
Right.
So I've been racking my head for years now about how to introduce all the kids and their like origins and how they join the family. And I play around with things like, oh, you know, I'm genetically related to these two, but, you know, these two joined us through adoption or whatever. And then I'm like, well, does that even cover it? I feel better about that. But it's kind of the same thing with biological. Like, well, the other ones, like, are they not alive? Are they not? Do they not have biology? And I know it feels very it feels very semantic. But part of me thinks, Melissa, get over yourself. It's just a thing. It's just what we do. And then the other part really cares about worms.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I think, you know, for my boys, like, I want to say it the right way to make them feel more comfortable. You know, I don't want to say anything that's going to kind of make them feel separated or different if they don't need to. You know, like, as a, you know, protective mom, you kind of want to make sure you're saying the right thing. That's probably why we do correct the people in public, to make sure they say the right thing around their child. You know, bringing home an older child, he's well aware that he was adopted. You know, he's well aware that he looks different than me. He's well aware that people ask all kinds of questions in front of him. He hates when people ask if they're twins. He'll say things very loudly, and I let him. You know, someone says, oh, are they twins? You go, why do people think I'm high? They think he's the same age as Noah. And he'll say it loud. And be like, well, you know what, buddy? Some people just don't recognize that you and Noah look very different. Or, you know, buddy, just, you guys are the same height, so they're just going to assume you're the same age, you know, even though they're not really paying attention to you, you know, like to try to give him some voice. But, you know, I totally allow him to say whatever he wants when people say something, and it really does bother him because he knows he's smaller than kids his age, and he's very self-conscious of it. And we talk about it probably every day to every other day, and I'll bring up reasons why being tall isn't so great, you know. My poor child has these two, like, very tall parents. So we are learning a whole new world of making sure things are at the height he can get to them, or he has a way to get to the height he needs to be to reach things. It's been a huge adjustment for Josh and I to, like, kind of squat down and say, okay.
I could have helped you out with that. You should have called me.
Well,
I could have totally short-proofed your house.
Probably should have had to come over and just, like, go over everything. But Nate is a very determined little boy, so he has a way to try to figure things out or to get help. Like, so it's not, you know, but it's been very interesting, and we talk about it all the time because he'll say things. I'm like, you know, buddy, you have two really tall parents right now. But guess what? Like, we get leg cramps from sitting in chairs that are too small, or we have to duck our head to go in places sometimes. You know, you don't have to worry about any of that. And he's like, yeah. So we always try to, like, talk up the, you know, it's not always great to be tall. Probably every other day we have a conversation about what's the benefit to being shorter than taller. to kind of just boost that self-esteem for him.
Yeah. Do you know Mother Teresa was like 4'8"?
Yeah. She was a very tiny woman.
I feel like that's maybe better for small girls, but I don't know. There's some, you know, I mean, I guess the lesson there is shortness doesn't have to hinder any of your great work in the world. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Being small does not stop you from doing anything. It does not stop him at all. Everyone is pretty impressed with, even with like his shorter legs and everything that he can do. Everybody's been incredibly impressed with his skills, and he worked very hard.
Yeah. So again, I want to be the like nippy person who just gives like the sarcastic response and walks away a lot of the time because I'm tired, and because again, we walk through this day after day. Whereas it might be that person's like first experience. Or first opportunity even to be educated. And when I'm in my logic brain and I'm fully regulated, I really want to give people the benefit of the doubt. And I want people to have the opportunity to be educated and to walk away feeling like they've been given the benefit of the doubt. But sometimes my humanness really just wants to be snarky. But I feel like that burns bridges.
I feel like there's like a line I always draw. Like if it's someone who's asking questions because they're genuinely interested in adopting or genuinely interested in my boys, you know, I'm going to probably answer more on the educational side of their inappropriate questions. Whereas if it's someone who's just asking a dumb question to ask a dumb question, I'm going to probably be more snarky. You know, I really want to educate people on what to say that's more appropriate, because I feel like if we never do, they're never going to learn what to say, and they're always just going to say the inappropriate thing. And I also want my boys to know that, you know, they should be proud that they're Chinese. They should be proud that they are adopted. You know, I don't want it to ever seem like it's something to hide or to not talk about. So, you know, when people ask questions, I'll, you know, answer as generally as I can. I'm not going to go into specifics of their personal adoption stories, you know, of everything they've been through. You know, I'll talk about my end of it gladly, and I'll share about the need in the world of adoption and children who need care, and a lot of policies and politics in the world that should change to keep children in homes in the first place. You know, but I, you know, generally want to like answer questions kind of more educationally when I can. But if I feel like it's not going to benefit my children or the person I'm talking to, then that's when I'm just going to probably give a snarky answer and walk away.
Yeah. One of my favorite responses, and I really need to like just practice responding to this or this way more often so it becomes a little bit more rote. But I loved the response, why do you ask? Because I feel like it puts the ball back in their court. It gives you a little bit more information like, oh, well, maybe they are serious about adoption. Maybe we want to build a bridge and not burn a bridge. Or, you know, maybe they knew someone who's adopted and they just never, you know, and they don't have the right language. Or maybe someone's just being nosy.
Yeah. There's that too.
So do people ask you, like, about the cost and their personal stories? You brought that up a little bit. I feel like for as odd as we look walking around, or I look, I mean, I used to have 6 kids that followed behind me like little ducklings, and they were older. They were, like, 14 to 5 or something like that, and there were 6 of them, and none of them really matched. No one really asked questions about us, but I'm pretty sure it's because they just assumed it could not be what they thought it was. So I don't think anyone thought that I was the mother of all of these children. But people that knew us, we didn't get the like traditional things that we say. We got more like, you know, why were they adopted? You know, like, why were they available for adoption? Or what happened here? Or, you know, are their moms dead? Or those kinds of things. Do you get a stat at all?
Yeah. I think with Noah, we got a lot of more of, oh, where is he from? How much was he? Kind of questions when it was just one little boy who was clearly like the outsider of the family, being the only Chinese one out of, you know, me taking my other kids around to look, you know, kind of exactly like me. And then with Nate, I feel like we got a few less questions because people kind of are more often trying to figure it out, you know, like there's 4 of them, and they'll, you know, look down at the boys and then see them run to me and then look up at me and look at the boys and kind of are trying to figure out, oh, wait, did they go with her? You know, so I feel like it takes people a little bit longer to figure out our family before they can ask the question. I'm usually already walking away. So, yeah, we got a lot of the weird questions at first with, you know, I was like, you can ask me about the cost of adoption, but, you know, my child didn't cost anything. Just, like, I wouldn't ask you, you know, when you get home from the hospital, your hospital bill when you have a baby, oh, how much was that one? If people just thought about it, it would make more sense. With Noah, everybody was very excited for us. I didn't get a whole lot of the whys. When I told people that I was adopting, we were adopting again, we got a lot of why, which I was just kind of like, well, you clearly didn't understand anything about our first adoption then if you're asking me why I'm adopting again. I feel like I need to make that a little more known. Again, like I said before, with like the miscarriage thing, like I feel like, you know, there's a chance to kind of educate people a little bit and like not just stay quiet about it, but kind of open up about adoption and the needs and stuff, you know. And our adoption was more than just, oh, I want a baby and I can't physically have one anymore. You know, there was a greater need and a greater calling than that, which, you know, kind of stood out, I guess, a little bit more with Nate's adoption. You know, I think everybody kind of figured that we adopted Noah just to fill that desire to have another baby because I couldn't physically have one anymore. But it was really a greater thing than that.
We definitely got that because similarly to you, we had two children within like 3 years of marriage, and on first sight, infertility was not something that we were struggling with. And so when we entered into the process of adoption, especially on Patrick's side of the family, we got a lot of questions about why are you adopting when you can obviously get pregnant. So it was very acceptable in their minds, like, oh, you adopt if you can't have children. And then, but a little bit mind-boggling to make the decision proactively. And, but I think that's so important because it's, I mean, honestly, it's really unhealthy to adopt just to only solely to fill that infertility need. I mean, it obviously is a round peg that fits in a round hole in a lot of ways, but it has to be so much more than that, I think, to be successful in the long run, because there's just so much emotional rough terrain and crazy things to navigate that you need something to anchor you more than, you know, this little person's going to fill one of my needs.
Right. Like, I think that can be kind of the spot starting the adoption is infertility issues, you know, but I think once you get into it, you know, hopefully most adoption agencies are getting better with educating families about, you know, all the other stuff that comes with adoption, you know, that even a newborn adopted from a hospital is going to have trauma, you know, like, so hopefully there's a lot more education being spread out there so that, you know, families are learning more than just that, oh, I want a baby and I can't have one, so I'll adopt one.
Yeah, definitely. So you walk through miscarriage, you walk through adoption, you have a child with a physical, very obvious special need. And then last winter, we all got the shocking news that you were fighting breast cancer, which really rocked my world because we're the same age, we've known each other forever. And so, as you know, I've had another guest on who is a breast cancer survivor, and we were good friends, but you were definitely the closest person to me in my circle to walk through something like that. Tell us a little bit about how that all panned out.
So it was actually about a year ago now. So it was last December. And actually, my husband was the one who felt the lump first. So advocate for husbands groping their wives. So grope your wife to save your life is what we say. He had felt the lump and kind of said something to me about it. And I was like, oh, huh. So I checked it out. And, you know, women, you know, we really should be doing breast exams. I hadn't been because really who has the time to even think about that? Give your husband permission to check because honestly, like, it's more fun for them anyway. And, you know, like, who cares? I don't even think about doing that. You know, so he had noticed something and said it. So I felt it. And honestly, as soon as I felt it, I was like, that's not right at all. But I didn't want to, you know, be negative about it. So I set up an appointment with GYN. Actually, I texted my mom. I was like, if you have a lump in your breast, you go to the GYN to get it checked, right? Just to be sure, because I had no idea. And of course, she was like, yes, why? What's wrong? And I was like, oh, there's a little lump. I'm just going to get it checked out. And to the GYN, she checked it and didn't really think it was that big of a deal. She's like, okay, well, you know, I'm going to send you to get a mammogram and a sonogram just to be safe and to, you know, watch it. And I was like, okay, that kind of gave me a little peace of mind. So I went and had my first mammogram, which that I was completely terrified of. I'd heard only horror stories of how much it hurts and how awful it is. And I was just sick thinking about it. So I went to go get the mammogram. And as I'm sitting, they have like a separate little waiting room for women who are there to get mammograms at the imaging center. And I'm sitting there in the corner of this little tiny waiting room is a little Christmas tree that's decorated in all breast cancer awareness stuff. And there's a TV, there's magazines, and all I could do was stare at the stupid tree thinking, what a horrible decoration to have in this room for women waiting to get mammograms. Like, we're all scared we might have breast cancer, and we're staring at this breast cancer awareness tree. It was just the most ridiculous thing. Like, I called back. I went in for my mammogram. It was not that bad. I'm sure some women it's probably worse, but honestly, if you've had a crazy, wild toddler boy who's, like, climbed all over you like you're a jungle gym, that's worse than the mammogram was. So I had that done, and then they did a sonogram. After the sonogram was finished, the woman was like, okay, I'm just going to go check with the radiologist, and I'll be right back. And I was like, okay. So I laid there and got a little nervous and prayed. I was like, you know, God, please let this be nothing. I, you know, don't have a whole lot of time for this in my life right now. And this is very nerve-wracking. And I just kind of felt him say, it's not nothing to me. And I was like, okay. And I kind of felt peaceful about it at the moment. The radiologist came in with a very solemn look on her face and said, you need to go see a breast surgeon and you need to get a biopsy done. And told me that, you know, there's a pretty solid mass in your left breast and we see some fluid in the lymph nodes in your armpit. So not really knowing what any of that actually meant, I was like, okay, so those are like red flags, right? And she was like, yeah, you really should get a biopsy done. And I was like, okay, can you guys just do that? Or she's like, oh, we can do it here, but you should probably go see a breast surgeon first. And that was kind of terrifying to hear. So I left there very nervous. They sent the results back to my GYN. She had called me that night. I missed the phone call. She left me like this like kind of frantic message saying, I need to go see a breast surgeon. They have one they can send me to. I should go right away. So the rest of that night, I barely slept because I was all panicked from her message. I called the next day and she told me you should go see a breast surgeon and then get biopsied. They would like to see you before you get biopsied because sometimes with the biopsy, it can cause bruising and stuff. And the breast surgeon would want to see, you know, what your breast looks like prior to the biopsy just to get a baseline. I was like, okay, that sounds a lot less scary. So I called and made an appointment with the breast surgeon to go see them, which I got it in pretty quickly. Josh and I both went, met with the doctor, and she said, you know, the mass feels pretty big and hard. We definitely need to do a biopsy. We're like, okay, any chance you can do it today? Just kind of hoping to get it over with. And she was like, no, I typically do them on Fridays, but this is a Tuesday. She said, I typically do them on Fridays, but I'm going to have you come in tomorrow to do it because I feel like it's pretty urgent. That was pretty scary to hear. So we were like, okay. So they sent me home with some numbing cream to use for the next day. That night was pretty terrifying. I've had three women I was very close to in my life all pass away from breast cancer. So breast cancer has kind of touched my life before. So kind of walking through this was really scary at the time. So we went in the next day. They did a biopsy of the breast and took some fluid out of the lymph node. That was way worse than the mammogram. So if you ever have a mammogram, just know it's not as bad as getting it biopsied. When everything was done, Josh came back in and she sat down with us and we asked her, okay, how soon will you have results? She said they should have preliminary results back by Friday. And so we kind of just asked her, you know, what are you thinking? And she just looked at us and said, I'm 99% sure that this is cancer. So it was pretty sobering to hear that just from taking a biopsy, she could tell it was cancer. So that following Tuesday, I got a call from the doctor's office to confirm my appointment for Wednesday. And as I was talking to the secretary, she was like, okay, I'm going to put you on hold because the doctor wants to talk to you. I was like, okay. So she got on and told me, yes, it is cancer. It is triple negative. And then she said a whole bunch of other things. And I have no idea what she said after that. Kind of all was like, you know, like Peanuts cartoon, like wah, 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 wah. As soon as I heard, like, yes, you have cancer. So I came down to Josh and I said, she said triple negative. I don't know what that is. So, you know, not knowing what it was, of course, we Google it, which is never a good thing to
do. Never. I hear that's the worst thing to do for your medical diagnosis.
It really is. Because you know how, like, everybody jokes that, like, whatever, you can have, like, a cough, and if you, like look it up on WebMD, you're now convinced you have cancer. like we Googled triple negative, which in hindsight, I'm very glad we did because we looked at what it was. Like I really had no idea anything about breast cancer, you know, so we learned a lot that day. I learned there are four types of breast cancer. There are three kinds of breast cancers that are fed by hormone receptors, and then triple negative is not fed by any. So we learned all kinds of things about triple negative and how, you know, all the bad stuff. And we cried most of the day. Just learning what it was and all that could happen was very scary. But I'm kind of glad because it kind of gave us that emotional release and we were able to like cry about it and look up stuff and write down questions. I called one of my good friends who's a nurse and I told, she kind of was aware of the situation that was happening and I told her what it was. And of course she Googled it too. And then she called me back in tears. Which is never a good thing when your friend who's a nurse is crying over hearing what your diagnosis is. So, but it kind of gave us a better idea of what we were facing. When we went in Wednesday for the appointment to meet with the doctor and the team and to go over what their plan for me was, we were able to have questions ready and I was past the emotional stage of it. At that time, I was able to kind of be present and hear what she was saying and ask questions and understand it all. So in retrospect, I'm glad we Googled it and had that time of figuring it out and understanding kind of what we were facing. So yeah, they told me, okay, this is it. This is serious. We want you to start immediately with chemo, and then we will move on to surgery. In between all of that, we'll do genetic testing, and we'll do all kinds of other CT scans and MRIs to check and see if the cancer's anywhere else, and so all that. So it was quite a whirlwind. You know, we found the lump at the end of December, and my first chemo treatment was on Valentine's Day.
So you went through treatment, and through chemo, you did lose your hair, and you had a mastectomy. So what have people said that was helpful, and what have people said that was so not helpful?
So the unhelpful things were, well, it's only breast cancer.
Opposed to what?
Well, that's the thing. but there's no good cancer ever, you know, and I feel like people who haven't had cancer would kind of think that there's a different level of each cancer. You know, any cancer is bad. Any cancer can take a turn. It can attack your entire body at any point. There are some cancers that are better researched than others, which isn't right. They all need to be, you know, I feel like we cure one or figure out how to cure one, like that can help us figure out how to cure them all. You know, cancer should be studied and funded like immensely for all cancers. But yeah, like saying that, oh, well, it's only breast cancer. I was like, okay, well, I know three women who died of breast cancer, like personally, and that's not even like the tip of the iceberg for how many people, you know, there's so many people who get
that's
breast cancer because
like I've lost so many people to breast cancer that that's like the last thing I would think. I feel like that's the,
yeah.
And maybe just because it's more well known, but I don't know.
And it is well known. And you know what? Like, Susan G. Komen did that. You know, like, she fought for people to know what it is, you know, to get it out there, to get people to know. And, like, so many people, like, know what it is because they know someone who's had it. A lot of people get breast cancer more often than other cancers, so there's a larger number of people who get it. So it's the survival rates for it seem better, but it's really, like, a larger pool of people that get it. So it's kind of skewed, I feel like. So a lot of people say, oh, well, it could have been worse. I don't really know how unless you've gone through it. Like, it's all bad. And anyone who has cancer supports anyone else who has had cancer or has cancer. You know, one of my really good friends, he has brain cancer, you know, and it's just as devastating and as hard, you know. And it's, you know, when I was diagnosed, you know, he was one of the first people to, like, be supportive of me and what I'm going through. And even, you know, he's going through more treatments now and, like, texting me the other day to ask how my surgery went, you know, like, you know, if I were to label anyone, I'd be like, man, like, that would be worse than this, but, you know, it's really not, it all sucks, really. And then I think one of the worst possible things is when someone finds out you have cancer, they have to tell you their cancer story of either the time they thought they had cancer or the person they know who's had cancer, and either like, oh, it was nothing, and they did great, and they were healthy the whole time, and they beat it, or, oh, yeah, I know someone with that cancer. Yeah, they died. I got all those stories. Like, all of them. Like,
this is the one I'm the most guilty of. I didn't do this to you, but I'm a story sharer. Like I said, I'm an oversharer. So I think that this is my downfall in listening to people share their stuff. I'm a story comebacker. Like, I always come back with a story.
And I didn't mind some of them, but a lot of them, it was like, you know, someone pulled me aside at church one day and told me, like, literally three stories of women he knows who had breast cancer, and all of them died. And I'm not really sure why I needed to hear any of them, you know, as I'm in the middle of the battle, but he felt the need to share it with me, and I was just like, okay, that's really depressing. Thank you. I don't really need to know the person you know who died of cancer. And then, you know, if someone has been through it, or they know someone who's been through it and has a tip, please share it. Like, that's great. Like, let me know, hey, you know what, make sure you take, like, some kind of hard candy or something to suck on when you go to chemo. Got it. Perfect. Thank you. Or, you know, this worked really well for me. You could try it. Or that, those tips are amazing. Not telling you, like, oh, I know someone who, they went through it and they weren't even sick. Like, first of all, I don't know what they went through, but if they weren't sick, then they weren't getting treatment. like, it's going to make you sick. So I don't mind, like, stories that have some kind of, like, helpful tip in them, or, like, some positive energy to it, you know, but I really don't want to hear, like, yeah, the stories of all the people, you know, who have died of cancer as I'm trying to, like, fight it, you know?
Yeah, not helpful. What were the most helpful things that people did?
So just, especially when it's, like, a family trying to fight, I know for us, like, the most helpful things really were, we had somebody just set up meals for us and took care of all of it. Like, I didn't have to really do anything. I gave some ideas of stuff my family likes, and that was all I had to do. I don't want to have to think about, you know, what meals and when, and they just kind of handled it and just said, can I do this for you? And I said, yes, and then they just took care of it. We had people send gift cards for, like, the movies or iTunes or, like, Chick-fil-A. I think at one point we had, like, $250 in Chick-fil-A gift cards, which was a huge blessing because, you know, Josh could just pick it up on the way home from work and not have to worry about meals that day. And my kids, of course, absolutely loved it. In fact, it's all gone now. Like, they get really upset when they come to Chick-fil-A. I'm like, not today, because mommy has to pay for it now. Cards of encouragement was really great. So I feel like, especially Christians, really feel like they need to say the right thing. They need to put some kind of positive, like, biblical spin on whatever situation you're in. And there isn't always one. You know, like, my favorite quote that people like to use is, God only gives you what you can handle, or God never gives you more than you can handle. It's probably the worst thing ever in the world, and I really wish no one would ever say it again, unless it's a joke, because it's not true. There's no biblical basis for that saying.
That was actually, and I haven't verified this, so I may just be totally spreading rumors here. I don't have to ask my master's of theology husband if it's true, but that you in that sentence was a plural you. And so that was in the letter to, I don't even know what the quote is, but a letter to a church body and to a community. And Paul is imploring that God wouldn't give the community more than they could handle collectively. And so that really has no bearing on our individuals.
Right. So that will make sense. Yeah. Because if it was just an individual, like, if God only gave us what we could handle, one, we would never need him or other people. Like, life would be super easy if we only were given what we could handle. To say that to someone when they're in the middle of something bad is just, it just doesn't make sense, and it doesn't help. But I feel like we feel like we have to say something to make it better. There's nothing you can say to make it better in any situation. It kind of is what it is. And I had blogged about it at one point, and I just kind of, to me, I said, here's what you can say to me, and I give you permission to say to anyone else in a horrible situation is, this sucks, I'm sorry, I'm here for you. That's really all you need to say to anyone in any bad situation, really, because give them permission to know that this sucks. Like, you know, I've had a lot of Christians that won't let you feel bad in a situation. It's like, no, we have to stay positive and happy, and we don't. God gave us all of our emotions to use at any time. Like, I can be angry about this. I can be sad about this. I can be happy about this. I can feel them all in one foul swoop, you know? Like, we're allowed to feel that this sucks. Like, this is not really what God's whole plan was to begin with. I don't believe that God gave me cancer. I believe that I got cancer because we live in a broken, horrible world that we've polluted, and that's why I have cancer. I also feel like a lot of people, you know, they need to make sure you, there's a silver lining, you know, like, okay, if you really want to look for one, maybe there's one there, or maybe you can make something out of it, but it doesn't always have to be. And, you know, I really feel like when you're in the middle of a storm, like, you just want someone to come hold your hand in the storm and anchor you. You don't need someone to tell you how you should be viewing the storm. Like, don't stand outside the storm and be like, look, it's going to be over soon. You're good. Look, there's a rainbow coming. Like, as I'm in a storm, I see lightning bolts and thunder and rain pouring down me, and I can't even hear you. But if you come hold my hand, I know you're there. If you're just yelling at me from outside the storm, I have no idea what you're saying, you know? Like, kind of my, like, way to kind of describe it. I know a lot of people want to say something to help you, and that's fine. Like, I think one of the best things, though, is people sent me cards, which is great, because I know they care, and I can read them when I'm ready. So, like, days I'm having a tough day, I really didn't want to read another card with scripture in it. So my mom actually got me a box, and I put all the cards people have sent me this whole year in the box. And, like, when I'm having a day that I need, like, to feel supported or I want to read something, I can pull out the cards and read them. And then the days that I'm just like, I can't take it, I just, card just goes right in the box. I'm like, thanks for the card. It's in the box now. So that way you can, like,
you need someone to, like, preview them for you, so you can have, like, the box of, like, cards to read when you want to, like, read scripture. And then, like, did you get any, like, really good ones that just either make you laugh or kind of more blunt in their messaging? I feel like you need a box for those too. I feel like maybe on different days, different cards might be good for you.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be good. And then that way you're like, you can think about what you're going to say to the person and, like, write it down and read it again to make sure it does sound okay. And then that person can read it when they're ready to read it. Because sometimes when you're in the midst of the horrible things, you're not going to even really hear or absorb what other people are saying because you're still processing it yourself. But then they can go back later and see it and know that you were there to, like, support them.
Well, I have been wrapping up with these two questions that I'm going to throw at you that I didn't ask you beforehand. Feel free to take a pass, but they're kind of just fun. One is, what are you not doing? This is, like, my new theme in my life to release, especially moms, women, people who feel like they have to have it all together, who spend way too much time scrolling on social media and feel like all the other people have it all together. It's to just admit to ourselves and to the world what we're not doing. So is there something that you would like to just release and admit that you're not doing?
Oh, man. Like, the stage of life, there's a whole lot of it. It's kind of been, like, this whole year has been a lot of not doing a lot of stuff that I did before. But probably the biggest one right now is school. Like, we're not doing a lot of school.
Yeah, us either. We're on my turn.
Because I just kind of don't have the time and energy most days.
Great. So we're both not doing school, so that's great. And then the last one is kind of on the opposite of that. What's your life hack?
Ooh, that's a good question. Probably my LuLaRoe leggings are my life hack right now because they're cute and fun and whimsical. So they, like, kind of brighten my day and make people around me smile too. And they fit. Unlike a lot of my other clothes right now. Chemo, one of the great side effects of that is water retention. So I'm up in weight right now. So a lot of my pants don't fit or they're tight and uncomfortable. And my leggings just fit amazing and feel good and make me happy. And you can wear, you know, a long shirt or dress with them and they can look, like, semi-appropriate for being out in public. So there's actually one morning I woke up and tried to put on jeans and it was just not happening that day. And I just kind of, like, looked at my husband, and he goes, just go put on your leggings and get on with your day, which is what I want to do anyway. And he just kind of gave me permission. And, like, you know, husbands don't always say the right thing at the right time, but he really did that day. So, yeah.
Well, Jen, thank you so much for being here and sharing your story with so much vulnerability and just giving a clue to the rest of us just to know what to say to those people around us who are walking through struggles. I so appreciate your bravery and your strength and your courage as I've been able to walk with you through the last couple years, and I'm just super glad that we're friends.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Just like we talked about last week, there's something so powerful about sharing our stories so that others won't feel alone. I'm so grateful for Jen's willingness to share her story and give great advice. If you have someone you love walking through a tough time, go ahead and post this episode on their social media and invite their village to listen and learn. When you post about the show, use the hashtag #TheUncorkedPodcast. I love connecting with listeners, and I'd love to connect you with Jen if her story resonated with you. You can find me on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at MA Corkum. Thanks for joining me, and have a great week.